BCFM 93.2 is a charity run entirely by volunteers. That means we are not for profit, so we can put you, the people of Bristol, first. BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Margaret Thatcher is dead, but who pulled her strings and why did her fellow Tories stab her in the back? Bristol tops international news bulletins this week with its spontaneous Monday night party. Several arrests, but no injuries. So, from 1979 to 1990, the Thatcher legacy, a Tory versus Labour view. We go back over the high spots or low spots of the Thatcher years. Plus, waste and recycling, as well as fracking in the Mendips, where much of our fresh water comes from. Is this a good idea? Hydraulic fracturing of the Earth's crust is releasing, amongst other things, a bit of gas. But is it just an attempt to make all natural water undrinkable? What is going on in the Mendips? And this week we saw the release of a Durham University report which gives fracking a clean bill of health. Only trouble is, it was written by a former expert for ExxonMobil, Professor Richard Davis. Plus, next weekend sees Bristol's annual Anarchist Book Fair. Will it be a festival of lawlessness and subversion? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Or do Bristol's anarchists actually have a point? And James Steele, America's mystery man in Iraq. This shocking BBC documentary showing torture and murder of prisoners of war was sanctioned right from the top, was made for the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War last month. But it still hasn't been shown on the terrestrial channels or anywhere else on the BBC. Is that a good way to use our licence fee payers' money? Make a programme that you don't show? Plus, a top Italian judge accuses Ken Clark's secret Bilderberg Club of being behind decades of terrorism throughout Europe. Bilderberg was started by a former SS officer. Top BBC manager Marcus Aegeus is also a member. And the latest leak suggests that Bilderberg may be meeting near London next month in Britain for the first time for 15 years. So now, I'm sorry we didn't have our weather forecast at the start of the last hour, so now here it is. Tonight, lows of 5 degrees Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs of 15 Celsius. Slightly wetter on Saturday than on Sunday. Some sunny spells and gusty winds. On to next week, highs of 17, getting sunnier, warmer and less windy as the week progresses. Next weekend, 20th and 21st of April, highs of 16, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And I'm joined on the line to begin with by Mohammed Rafiq from London. Hi, Mohammed, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you, John.
You used to work at the Bank of England, and one of the things that we'll be discussing in a bit more depth in a minute is the Thatcher legacy. But you have some specific knowledge about the Big Bang. This took place really just a couple of years after she was elected. Can you tell us what was the Big Bang?
Well, firstly, just a minor correction there. It was front ends of the Bank of England, the old discount houses that used to issue the national debt on behalf of the Bank of England rather than within the bank itself. But it was effectively an extension of the Bank of England.
Okay, and it all happened on the 27th of October 1986. Well, what changes did you see in the city?
Well, what happened? I mean, you've got to go back to the word itself. We know whenever I try to explain to people what happened, the first thing to understand is the word deregulation. It's blindingly obvious, but many people miss the fact that it actually means take the rules away. So basically, prior to the deregulation, there were many rules and laws in place that restricted the type of activities that a bank could do. So if you think, just say for instance, retail banking, a retail bank couldn't give a man in the street a mortgage. You would have to go to a building society for that. In the same way that a building society couldn't give somebody a current account. So those are things that people, I think, can relate to as a couple of the kinds of changes that went on. With inside the structure of the city itself, there used to be, you know, the old-fashioned merchant banks, there were investment banks, wholesale banks, discount houses, lots of different specialised institutions, and basically deregulation allowed financial institutions to enter into markets and business arenas that they previously hadn't been in. I think that's one of the best ways of thinking of it. And reducing the amount of regulation around that. So, and that actually continued under Gordon Brown. Gordon Brown even believed in regulation light. So the strange thing was that even under the Labour government that followed all those years of conservatism, he carried on moving forward with the idea of removing more and more rules and changing the rules so that banks became self-regulating and financial institutions for that matter. So the theory is now that most financial institutions are to a large degree self-regulated, and that self-regulatory department, the risk and compliance department, effectively reports into the regulator the activities of the institution rather than the FSA that would be in this day and age, although that's just bifurcated. But the FSA was for a long time the sole regulator. Interesting deregulation, part of that process was to take all the different types of regulators. So those firms that were regulated by insurers, by FINRA, by IMRO, the Investment Management Regulatory Organisation, the banks, under the Bank of England, were all brought under a single regulator. That was another key strategic objective of Big Bang, was to give a single regulator for everybody. And of course now post-financial collapse, we see a very recent development which is reversing that ideology, and that all the money that was spent on that, and now we've got the banks going back to the Bank of England, two types of prudential regulator coming out to manage different parts of insurance firms. So they are really confused.
Mohammed, one of the people who was on this programme a couple of weeks ago, Rowan Boswell Davis, who was on Good Friday actually, he's been in The Independent this week talking about what he says, it's criminal to let the cheating bankers escape with impunity. He tells a story which he didn't tell us on the radio, which he tells in the national press. I once sat next to a board director of a major high street bank, he says, at a private dinner. Earlier in the day he'd listened while I spoke about the laws on money laundering, and I pointed out the penalties for non-compliance. He said to me, you were wrong in one important aspect of your presentation. People like me, people from our class, will never be prosecuted for money laundering or any other financial crime. We are a protected species. Now, to what extent was that idea of some people being a protected species, do you think, related to all of this deregulation that happened in 1986?
Well, one of the things about the changes in the regulatory structure, one of the drivers was actually Barings, the collapse of Barings Bank, and there was something that was brought into the regulatory changes which became the June 2000 Financial Services and Markets Act, when that was a bill which I think they started going through rounds of negotiation of that bill somewhere around 1998, somewhere around then, when the euro was happening. So because the euro was happening and because Y2K was happening, the year 2000 stuff was all going on at that time, a lot of other changes which kind of came into the regulatory framework weren't as prominent as they should have been, and people didn't understand them. But one of the things that occurred was this idea, you know, under Barings, when the directors turned around and said of Nick Leeson, well, you know, how are we supposed to know what some guy's doing in some office over in Kuala Lumpur or somewhere in the Asia? You know, we're the board of directors here in the UK, but it's not our job to know that. And the regulators turned around and said, no, we don't feel that's correct. And something known as the, nicknamed in the industry, the Nick Leeson Amendment came out. And what that did was it identified something known as approved roles. So if you're doing a particular type of role within the bank, you had to be an approved person, and that's in place to this day. So typically the head of risk or chief risk officer is an approved person, as is the CFO, the chief financial officer, and the CEO, the chief executive officer. Now, in a small firm, what you might find, Tony, is that all three of those roles merge into one person. And obviously, the larger the institution, the more you end up with two people or three people. And in some cases, even more than that, you might have several people in a risk department sharing that approved status. Now, what they did, and this is now is to send, I had to explain that because it's central to the point you've just raised. What they said was, if you are one of these approved persons, we will make you individually and severally liable. So what the regulations say is, not only is your company liable for its conduct, but as a person in one of these approved roles, who is the regulator's man, the point man or woman inside the institution who's looking at what's going on, we will make you personally liable for up to 2 years in jail and large fines, etc., if you don't blow the whistle on your own company, effectively. So all of that was put in place, and the question arises now, was it window dressing? That's the real big question. Has anyone ever been prosecuted under those rules, in spite of everything that's gone on? Has anybody ever been fined? My experience of major global institutions who are operating in the City of London, I saw two approaches, just as something for people to sort of see the way that this was viewed by institutions internally. I saw a European financial institution include as part of its remuneration package insurance for legal fees. I think they covered up to £500,000 of legal fees, so that somebody doing that approved role, if they found themselves, and this extended for up to 3 years after leaving the company, if they left the company, they would actually have somebody there facing legal fees.
That sounds almost, Mohammed, that sounds almost like danger money.
It is tantamount to danger money. I would agree with that. Interestingly enough, I saw an approach by an American institution, who shall remain nameless, and I spent some time trying to explain to the board members in EMEA, the Europe, Middle East, Africa board, about these new rules and the position that they were in, thinking that we'd be able to get the compliance department to maybe put some kind of insurance in place for them too, since they were taking on this responsibility. And I found myself on the receiving end of a roasting from the head of compliance, who didn't want them to know about these changes and didn't want them to be taking these insurances out. And I said, why ever not? And he said, because if anything goes wrong, the company can pin it on them.
Well, this is interesting to know, but I mean, what ultimately, though, Mohammed, and finally, this 2008 crash, to what extent do you think that it could have or couldn't have happened without the 1986 Big Bang?
That was absolutely totally responsible. Anybody that denies that link, it doesn't know what they're talking about. Absolutely doesn't. It was the deregulation that allowed these institutions, and what was known as the 1996 Market Risk Amendment, which came out of Basel, the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, the Basel One, the Capital One, the New Capital Accord, as it's known, CAD 2, and then the later thing Capital Accord 3. But basically, under Basel 2, they were allowed to decide what level of leverage. Now, among the idea is the trade-off, the horse trading in all of this was that we're going to come in with the pliers on the regulation front and hold you more firmly to account as directors of the bank, etc. But on the flip side to that, we will allow you to run your own risk models, which allow you to determine what you think is the appropriate capital to hold against the exposure that you've got and the leverage that you've got out there. And of course, that's where it's all gone wrong. I mean, we saw very recently, for instance, this chap nicknamed the London Whale. We saw that he suddenly had massively overexposed the bank simply by requesting changes to what are known as the VAR models, the VAR, the value at risk models, which effectively it meant that he could take larger and larger exposures in the marketplace for the same amount of capital being held to underwrite that position.
I mean,
it used to be known as fractional reserve banking a long time ago, but of course, fractional reserve banking hasn't existed for about 16, 17 years now.
Mohammed, given that we don't have arrests of these directors, as we were sort of, you were kind of speculating that might have happened, how do we fix this?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the regulators have become poodle regulators. That's the rubber stamp. The only thing to do is actually to force the banks to take, and other financial institutions, sensible measures. Unfortunately, we see, for instance, very recently, there's something known as the Solvency II Directive, which is supposed to be covering all the insurance companies over Europe. And we've already seen the European regulators and the British regulator all backpedaling on going live with this. And I make the point that we've spent 12 years or more trying to get the insurers in Europe to comply with capital requirements. They've repeatedly failed and refused to do that. And you do have to start saying, if you don't pull licenses off the firm, and if you don't actually start putting people in jail and bringing them into line, kicking and screaming, then it's going to happen again and again and again. They've got too much liberty now, far too much.
Mohammed Rafiq, former Bank of England employee and now a consultant around the world on banking. Thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Martin, what's your take on this?
The point was being made there that the big bang in the City of London, Margaret Thatcher's curate's egg, is responsible directly for the banking crash. And in the week that she died, I think that's the point that people need to take.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, Martin, our little tour around the world's hotspots before we go back to talking about Margaret Thatcher again in a minute. The Kissinger cables this week, released by WikiLeaks. Julian Assange has been busy in his incarceration in the Ecuadorian embassy. We mentioned him in the first hour too. And it's the Kissinger cables this time. Tell us a bit about the Kissinger years when he was Secretary of State under Nixon in the 1970s.
Well, there's a mountain of things to say about Kissinger. Basically, he can't travel to all countries in the world because there are warrants out for his arrest in various countries. Christopher Hitchens, before he lost his marbles, wrote a very good book exposing Kissinger's misdeeds, which included, of course, the secret bombing of Cambodia, the overthrow of the democratically elected government of Chile. The list goes on. And he's still there, still giving advice, and he was popping up on RTV this week eulogising guess who?
Not before we go off the subject of Kissinger entirely, because he is the sort of great guy who always goes along to these Bilderberg conferences. We also hear this week that Bilderberg is behind terrorist attacks. The Italian Supreme Court president has dropped a bombshell this week. Shocking information coming out of Italy confirms what many of the so-called conspiracy theorists have known for a long time. There is a secretive Big Brother body behind much of the violence in Europe and America, including terrorist attacks and assassination attempts as well. You had to attack civilians, the people, women, children, innocent people, unknown people, far removed from any political game. That was a quote from Vince Guerra, who is a fascist, who explained in sworn testimony, the reason was quite simple. They were supposed to force these people, the Italian public, to turn to the state to ask for greater security. This is the political logic that lies behind all the massacres and the bombings which remain unpunished, because the state cannot convict itself or declare itself responsible for what happened, he added.
Yes, well, Andreotti, the former Prime Minister of Italy, did in fact admit in the Italian Parliament that this was the case and that the intelligence services had been responsible for most of the terrorism in Italy. The guy is Imposimato, I think his name, Francesco Imposimato, who is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, and he's basically saying our investigations show that the intelligence services were the authors of the Strategia di Tensione, the Strategy of Tension, which began with the bombing of Piazza Fontana in 1969 in the Banca Agricola, which killed 9 people, bombing in Bologna railway station in 1980, which killed 86 people, all carried out by NATO intelligence services, according to Italian law enforcement. You don't hear that on Radio 4, do you?
No, you certainly don't. And Norway authorities face Utøya court case. This is published on last Friday. Families of victims of the Utøya shootings are considering legal action against both the police and the Norwegian state for failings which allowed Anders Behring Breivik to commit the worst spree killing by a single gunman ever to occur in peacetime. 69 people were killed on the island on 22nd of July 2011. The victims were mainly children and young people. Amongst the most damning facts to emerge from the original Norwegian government report was that police had received an accurate description of Breivik over the phone, along with the license plate number of his vehicle that he used to travel to the island. The employee who took the call then failed to pass the information on. The first two police officers to arrive at the scene in Utøya hid behind a skip on the mainland, despite being only 700 metres, that's nearly a kilometre, from Utøya. A police helicopter couldn't be mobilised because only two pilots, apparently, were qualified to fly it, and both were on holiday. Jerry Robert Christensen, whose 15-year-old daughter Birgit Smetback, that Breivik had shot twice, told Norwegian Daily Aftenpost, and he believes the political process in Parliament after the 22nd of July Commission report has led nowhere.
Yes, and of course what people in Norway suspect, who are informed, like Torstein Vidal, who we've had on this programme, is that this is part of the Gladio structure, that is to say, the structure of Western Intelligence Service promotion of terrorism. And of course the Swedish police are still investigating the murder of Olaf Palme, the former Prime Minister of Sweden, because that is suspected to be carried out by NATO intelligence services. Again, this isn't Radio 4, this is Bristol Community Radio. We're going to tell you what's going on in the world at large. The police in Sweden and in Italy think that the intelligence services, that includes the British intelligence services, are terrorists. No surprises in Belfast, but a few surprises for people in Bristol.
Birgit Smetback died of bullet wounds after waiting 3 hours for help to arrive. She was not evacuated until 8:15, approximately an hour and 40 minutes after Breivik had been arrested. Her father's one of many bereaved parents who are preparing to sue. Any connections with these original Gladio attacks we were talking about?
Well,
just
I mean,
now,
the
Martin?
Point is, those who are informed about Gladio and know what, and people can do any search on a computer, but G-L-A-D-I-O, Gladio, it will all come up. In actual fact, this has been in the public domain for many, many years. I mean, in Italy, they've known about this for many, many years. The intelligence services, the Western intelligence services, NATO in particular, there's a book called NATO's Secret Armies by Daniel Ganser, who's a Swiss academic. You can just put Gladio into a search engine, it will all come up. It's been well known for many years that the Western intelligence services have fomented right-wing, left-wing and Islamic terrorism as part of a control strategy, what was called in Italy the strategy of tension. It's not actually secret, it's out there in the public domain, but the mainstream media do not bother to tell people.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, on to Mrs. Thatcher and her legacy. Europe killed her. This is at least one theory. What are your thoughts on this, joined by Julian Parry from Somerset? What do you think, Julian?
Well, good evening, everybody. I think that Mrs. Thatcher had a dual role in her dealings with the British public. She was certainly faced with problems with the unions when she came to power, where the unions were undoubtedly trying to take over government, and somebody clearly had to do something about that. That couldn't be allowed to persist. But at the same time, I think after that, it was a question of destroying industry to ensure that only a certain number of people were able to take part in government and to rule this country, which was sad. And during her machinations on all of that, of course, we got Big Bang. She repealed the Usury Act and the Moneylenders Act. And we've ended up today with things like Wonga.com, who are currently under investigation, shall we say, because of their wider effects upon society.
This usury money lending, what's the relevance of that, Julian?
Well, there was a time when money lenders were not allowed to lend more than at a greater annual interest rate than 48%, I seem to think.
But I mean, when she came into power, inflation was through the roof. Interest rates were massively higher. Wasn't it 17%, Martin? I'm not sure exactly. Something really enormous interest rates, anyhow.
Oh, yes, we've all suffered at those sorts of rates, but we're not suffering at things like 4,000%, which some poor people are now saddled with.
Okay. What's your view about the final sort of denouement on the 31st of March 1990? We had 200,000 people in Trafalgar Square, the poll tax riots. But later that year... We had a bit of a conflict over Europe, didn't we? Margaret Thatcher had sat down with Jacques Delors and other leaders of the European Union countries, and she didn't like what she heard.
No, in actual fact, she announced to the House of Commons, no, 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 I seem to remember. And I think she was quite right in that, because I think the European Union is an example of where you concentrate power in the hands of the few, and in this case, the unelected few, and you end up with a dictatorship. They would like to say that, oh, you need this consensus for planning the future and all the rest of it. There are, of course, other economic and environmental commentators like John Greer, who will tell you that dissensus is the major thing that we need now as we approach some pretty...
What do you mean by dissensus?
Well, it's the opposite of consensus. If you've got consensus, everybody's thinking the same thing. Dissensus ends up with a lot of people having a lot of different ideas, and some of them are going to come good. If you have consensus politics all the time, you never explore the other possibilities that mankind may have at their disposal to survive past the oil age, which is going to be the next great crunch that the whole of the Western world particularly is going to experience.
Martin, we had in March 1990 the Battle of Trafalgar, 200,000 people and the poll tax riots in Trafalgar Square. But then we had this business of Europe in October 1990. Of course, Mrs. Thatcher was toppled by Michael Heseltine standing against her the month after that. What's your thoughts about the real reasons for her being stabbed in the back, essentially, by the Conservative Party, who are being so congratulatory of her this week and next week?
Well, I think there were two main reasons, as has been alluded to. One was they began to realise that there was a... I mean, for example, after the disturbances in Trafalgar Square, which were largely provoked by the police, to be honest, I was there and I saw what happened. It wouldn't have happened if the police hadn't been so aggressive. But the fact was that those pictures started to impact on things like the pound. The pound lost several pfennigs against the Deutschmark the following day. And I think that sort of thing started to make people wonder whether she was really in control of the situation. And the other fact was that there was a massive split at the top in the Conservative Party about Europe. And, you know, there was therefore two motives to remove her, and she was removed. Although I understand from people inside information that we're getting that many of those who removed her were also involved in illegal arms, nuclear arms deals with the Arms Corps in South Africa. And they used her removal as a mechanism for getting her to sign over money to Astra Holdings, which was being run by Stephen Koch, a former MI6 agent, who was basically selling South Africa's nuclear weapons on the black market to the British government via Astra, and then they subsequently lost them.
Well,
individual members of the Conservative Party profited from that, and the Conservative Party as a party took £17.8 million into the 1992 general election, according to the information that we're getting.
Anyway, my view is that it's pretty clear why she was removed from power from the Conservative Party, and that is because of this speech. You alluded to it just now, Julian. We're going to hear a little excerpt from it now.
We would not be prepared to have a single currency imposed upon us, nor to surrender the use of the pound sterling as our currency. It is our purpose to retain the power and influence of this House and not to denude it of many of the powers. Yes, the Commission does want to increase its powers. Yes, it is a non-elected body, and I do not want the Commission to increase its powers against this House. So, of course, we are differing. Of course, the President of the Commission, Mr. Delors, said at press conference the other day that he wanted the European Parliament to be the democratic body of the community, he wanted the Commission to be the executive, and he wanted the Council of Ministers to be the Senate. No. No. No.
Oh, that's Margaret Thatcher there speaking in October 1990, literally just a couple of weeks before she was removed from office. Now, let's just go have a look at some of the other things that that happened during the Thatcher years. In 1979, we heard already a little bit about abolition of exchange controls, opening up the UK economy to the will of the market. The 1982, the Falklands, and you know, whether that had an influence. But Martin, the miners' strike in 1984, this was a massive battle, closed 150 coal mines.
Yes, and I think thinking back to what Julian was saying about trade unionism earlier, if Barbara Castle had succeeded in persuading the union leadership to accept in place of strife in the 1960s, we might have developed in this country the kind of it's not a soft touch trade unionism, but consensus trade unionism, as we see in Scandinavia, where the unions use their bargaining power as a mechanism for building the economic structure. Britain. And Margaret Thatcher didn't break out of this. Britain is locked in the 19th century struggle between capital and labour, which other societies have managed much more successfully than we have.
Yes, in that sense, we have a divided society, and a divided society, divided against itself, cannot succeed. And that is why we have seen Big Bang bring forward an economic situation which is unsustainable, because the Big Bang was that he brought forward the idea and the concept that it was only the finance industry that could earn enough money to support this country.
Now, you said, Julian, just now that we had the unions running the country. Well, actually, they do have a... I mean, they're big organisations, they're democratic organisations, they represent those people. I mean, surely there was bound to be some sort of clash of ideology. And if you look at the miners' strike, well, isn't that one of the reasons that we don't have, or we have a serious problem now with producing energy into the future, with the lights going out, the threat of the lights going out, not due to union action, but just due to the collapse of our energy market?
I think that we've got to say that there is a problem with an economy whereby one group tries to take over and impose its total view on the rest of society. And there is no doubt about it that Scargill, Jack Jones and Hugh Scanlon all tried that game, and they had to be put back. I can remember a time when the General Secretary of the Trade Union Conference was standing outside Downing Street saying, "We've been in to see the government and we're telling them, so steady she goes, but watch it, watch it." I mean, to say, how rude. And obviously there had to be a backlash against it, but that backlash was then taken even further and melded into the European era as well. And what we've got today is total control by a very few people, and I'm sure that that's what they wanted. But their control is so ineffective that what we have is the Western world actually falling apart. And I think it'll be about 15 years, 20 years coming now, when the oil crisis gets to the point where the Western world will fall apart for lack of energy.
Well, we've still got the coal is still over there because the mines were closed. But Martin, 1984 was Margaret Thatcher versus Arthur Scargill. We're going to hear a little clip now, including the voice of Arthur Scargill. He is getting together. This is 40 years after the Battle of Saltney Gate, which was near Birmingham. And this is Keith Wilkinson from Central TV reporting.
Seldom before or since has there been a protest like the one called the Battle of Saltney Gate in 1972. Thousands of workers in Birmingham marched on a gas-board coking plant in an incredible act of solidarity to help striking coal miners block the gates.
We know they're going to do him, they say. No filming. Yeah, no filming, you see. As soon as it's them that gets knocked down, they don't want to film it.
It meant to me that everything I dreamed about as a trade unionist crystallised on that day. Working people from different industries saw the need to come to the assistance of those who were battling against odds that were really unfair. In 2012, understand the need for the Midlands Spring, for the British Spring, and change our society.
Well, there's Arthur Scargill there comparing... I don't think he's been knighted yet, has he, Martin? Not Sir Arthur Scargill yet. Comparing, really, what was going on. I mean, that was the 70s, obviously, not the 80s, that particular battle, but those kind of battles were going on very much so during the miners' strike in 1984. And he's saying, actually, you know, that these struggles continue, and he's comparing the anniversary of that battle in Birmingham to the Arab Spring.
Yes, I mean, well, he's going to fight his corner loudly as he always does. I mean, I think what's interesting about the 72 and 74 miners' strikes is that they were both carried through on proper ballots according to NUM rules, which in 1984, for various reasons which we could go into, Scargill decided to run it on the basis of delegate conference, which of course meant that that Nottinghamshire, which had been balloted out both times in 72 and 74, didn't come out, which then meant there was huge struggles to try and force them out. And I think that led back to Saltley Gate, because what happened at Saltley Gate is that the trade union militants got the idea that they could, without using ballots, force people out on strike. Now, sometimes you can do that, but it's actually a bad policy, and that's why the NUM rulebook forbade it, as traditionally run.
OK, let's look at privatisation now, creation of the cartels, as we were talking about earlier on. Privatisation raised something like £30 billion for the Exchequer, selling off nationalised industries, and that was, and also that to that, you can add £18 billion, which was added to the Exchequer from the sale of council homes. Well, privatisation was nothing new. The enclosure of land had been going on for a space of 200 years. That's the privatisation of land in Britain from the 1680s to the 1880s. Cabot Circus has been privatised. That was a bit of public land, which is now privatised. But in the early 1980s, we had the buses, British Steel, British Aerospace, BT, British Telecom and British Gas all privatised, Julian.
Yes, that was part of Margaret Thatcher's thrust. I must say that I look at it back on it, and I'm not sure that it did us that amount of good.
Well, what did you think at the time?
Well, one was rather confused about what was going on, because it was a time of tremendous upheaval. I must admit, I didn't take any part in it. But what I can see now from society and the way society is, you know, really and truthfully, government has to control the networks, be it the road network, the rail network, the electrical network, the water network, whatever, because you have to have supply security. And in a few years' time, as I say, we're coming to the end of the oil age, the need for that will become more and more obvious as society struggles to maintain its standard of living.
We had a lot of things there, Martin. Buses, British Steel, British Aerospace, BT, British Gas in the late 80s. British Leyland, the car industry, was privatised. Sealink, the ferries, Rolls-Royce, British Airways, the airlines, British Petroleum and the water and electricity.
And, of course, British advisers then went all over the world, including Eastern Europe, Latin America and Africa, and advised them, on pain of having their debts not rolled over, that they had to privatise everything. So Britain pioneered this privatisation revolution. And, in fact, of course, some industries, probably like BT, for example, probably better off in the private sector, I would argue, because you've got a change in the technology. So it's no longer a network that needs to be controlled. Mm. So therefore, that can be run in the private sector. But what Margaret Thatcher has done is she's turned the debate about privatisation into a huge ideological argument, when it ought to be a technical argument, which industries are best in which kind of management. And it shouldn't be I'm a socialist, so everything's got to be run by the state, and it shouldn't be I'm a capitalist, so everything's got to be run by the private sector. In actual practice, in the real world, these are judgment calls which should be made upon practical criteria.
Julian, would you agree with that?
Yes, I would to a degree, but the fact of the matter is that what it meant was that rather than being held publicly, an awful lot of shares, a lot of industries, ended up in the hands of the favoured few. And we've seen the whole control of society handed down to a very, very few people, and it's going wrong.
Martin, then we had moving a little bit further forwards, this is after the Thatcher era, we then had another wave of privatisations: British Coal, National Grid, Power Gen, British Airports Authority, British Rail, which we were talking about earlier on, and Air Traffic Control.
Well, yes, I mean, this has gone on all over the... I mean, the basically, even under New Labour, or especially under New Labour, the idea became, and it's all over the world that this idea took root, private is better, public is worse. In actual fact, a mixed economy, which is how basically most economies were run from 1940s to 1970s, was not a bad way to manage things. And there was always going to be an argument. So even the Conservative government nationalised Rolls-Royce to protect the infrastructure and allow it to, and then privatise it back to the private sector once they'd done that. It never used to be treated as a huge test of ideological purity one way or the other. It was something that was approached in a pragmatic way, and that, of course, is what should have been happening all along. I mean, bringing ideology into it has actually been very destructive.
Well, one thing I will say about Margaret Thatcher is she was very, very good at actually dealing with hecklers, something that we don't actually get anymore. I mean, it would be nice to have a few more managing to smuggle their way into the National Party conferences. And here's an example of a heckler at one of the Margaret Thatcher's party conferences and how she dealt with them.
Never prophesy, especially about the future. Nevertheless, never mind, it's wet outside. I expect they want it to come in. You can't blame them. It's always better where the Tories are.
Well, maybe not an entirely fair point that she's made there, but also she was very good at actually thinking on her feet, Julian.
Yes, she was. But one thing I'd like to point out is that huge shifts in our society and the balance of our society have taken place over these last few years because of the individuals involved, and a very few of them have actually shifted the whole balance of society in a couple of ways. And there have been comment upon it, and there are two that I'd like to bring forward. One is about Scargill and Jimmy Reid, no slouch when it came to defending the workers in the Govan shipyards. He was the great communist leader. He once said of Scargill, if the kamikaze pilots had had a union, Arthur Scargill would have made an ideal president, because of course he did in the end encourage things in a way that ended up with the exact opposite of his heart's desire, and it destroyed the coal industry.
Well, part of the reason for that, of course, Martin, was we were hearing the other week, weren't we, the enemy within was MI5 had actually infiltrated the coal miners union.
Yes, I mean, if we could go back over and refight the miners strike, there were various tactical mistakes made by Arthur Scargill, but he had, I mean, at the time, I was on the picket lines with miners, and people couldn't quite understand what the strategy was. In actual fact, what he tried to do, he got the biggest vote of anybody in the NUM electoral history, 80% plus, and he took that as a kind of mandate to do everything his own way, and he didn't carry the troops with him. And of course, by getting ahead of his own troops, he then found himself forced to try and do things without ballots, which then caused further problems and so on. Now, in actual fact, what should have been happening in Britain from the 60s onwards is that the union should have been brought in to managing the economy, not to run it, but as partners, which of course is exactly how they run it in Norway, Iceland and other sensible places.
Okay, and in 1985 we had the Battle of the Beanfield. One person with a fractured skull, a heavily pregnant woman clubbed with a truncheon and sledgehammers used to destroy the vehicles of the travellers, and that happened here in the West Country, Martin.
Yes, I mean, we've all got stories. I mean, the amount of times I've been out protesting against Margaret Thatcher, I can't remember a hell of a lot, but many people will remember.
And this was the peace convoy of travellers who were heading over to Stonehenge and were basically ambushed by the police.
The ITN journalists who filmed it said at the time there'll have to be a public inquiry into this because, you know, we've got pregnant women being bashed around by burly police officers, and they broke loads of windows in these vans and things and stuff like that. Very dangerous.
Yeah, and if anyone...
All filmed by the ITN, and ITN will have to be a public inquiry.
Well, if people are interested in following up on
that. Nor at Hillsborough, nor at Orgreave, of course. What happened at Orgreave was the police attacked the miners. 96 of them were put on trial for a fray. They all got off because the police were making it all up. It was a setup by the police. And of course, what I remember was the riots in the 1981, which was provoked largely where I was living in Brixton by a very arrogant attitude on behalf of the local police towards local black youths. Basically, there's a lot of water under the bridge with this history, and I'm afraid people are bitter and divided about her legacy.
Okay, 1985, that was the Battle of the Beanfield, as I said. There's a very good documentary you can watch online or possibly buy as a DVD called Operation Solstice about that. 1986, Martin, was Wapping and the abolition of the GLC. Now, Ken Livingstone, the Labour leader of the GLC, was elected, and Mrs. Thatcher abolished it.
Yeah, they abolished the GLC because they knew very well that he would win any election that he stood in, because he tried to improve the transport infrastructure. And of course, that was struck down by the House of Lords, who said, you've got to run London Transport.
Well, he wanted to make London Transport free, didn't he?
That's where he was going with it, yes. And of course, and then those days they had business rates which went straight to the GLC, so a small rate rise on the city gave him plenty of resources to do anything he wanted to do. And of course, the establishment were really unhappy with that, because he can basically do what he wants. He's able to tax the City of London, which is doing pretty well, so he's got plenty of money to take off them, and therefore he can build his own political base. So they had to destroy the whole GLC to get rid of him. these yet another of the injustices of the era, which have left us with a transport infrastructure in London which is substandard, to say the least.
And now we're looking at possible privatisation of the Royal Mail, the police, the prisons, school, the NHS. This kind of privatisation programme is carrying on, Julian.
Absolutely. And when you start to hear of them privatising the police and the prisons, you can talk about the Royal Mail to a degree, but police and prisons, you know that the whole affair is gone a step too far, because a basic principle of government is that you are there to protect the people with the army and dispense justice, and that is not something that can be privatised.
Okay, Julian Parry, thanks very much for joining us.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Now, James Steele, America's Mystery Man in Iraq. This shocking BBC documentary showing torture and murder of prisoners of war was sanctioned right from the top, was made for the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War last month, but it still hasn't been shown on the BBC. Let's have a listen to a clip from it now. It was made by the BBC Arabic Service and by The Guardian.
It's harder to end a war than begin one. Everything that American troops have done in Iraq, all the fighting, all the dying, the bleeding, and the building, and the training, and the partnering, all of it has led to this moment of success.
This documentary tells one of the great untold stories of the Iraq War. How the US administration funded a deadly, sectarian, paramilitary force to fight those threatening the American presence. It was a decision that helped fuel a sectarian civil war that ripped Iraq apart. At its height, 3 years later, 3,000 bodies a month were showing up on the streets of Iraq. This is also the story of the man the Pentagon sent in to organize and train those paramilitary squads. He's a veteran of America's so-called dirty wars, stretching back to Vietnam and El Salvador.
To President George W. Bush, CC, Vice President Richard B. Cheney, from Donald Rumsfeld. The attached memo is from a person we have sent into Iraq from time to time, essentially to work with the Iraqi police.
So who is James Steele, and why did the Pentagon choose him to go to Iraq?
I witnessed him, observing the crime of a prisoner being tortured in front of him.
We're in a room in the library interviewing Steele, and I'm looking around, I see blood everywhere.
I saw one room that had 75 prisoners all crammed into one small space, and they asked for food, they asked for help, and they asked for medical aid. We gave them every bit of scrap of food that we had, every bit of water. You could see evidence of a torture chamber where they had a broken lamp, where they used electrical shock, and it was just, it's quite evident what they had been doing to these fellas.
Southall's commander approached the man who appeared to be in charge of this torture center. According to Southall, the man immediately got on the telephone to U.S. military headquarters.
Right after he made that phone call, the order came that we were to stand down. We were ordered to pull away right now. That order came from someplace very high. We went directly back to our compound. The commander called us all in there together and told us that what we saw didn't happen, and to forget about it.
To forget about it. Martin, this is an appalling state of affairs. This guy's still running around, apparently, in Iraq, and he was organising torture. I mean, quite clearly, it was an official... I mean, he had lines right up to Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and they knew exactly what he was doing. He was torturing people. So how come this guy is still able to run around? Why hasn't he been arrested?
Because it's standard procedure, and that's what they've been doing in lots of other places, in El Salvador and elsewhere. And of course, we had Ben Griffin, the ex-SAS guy, phoning in to this program some months ago, and of course he was involved in all of this, and they saw everything that was happening. The Americans, the US government, goes around torturing and murdering people.
So why the BBC, with our licence fee payers' money, making documentaries, and then they won't show them on the TV? Isn't that a bit of a waste of money?
Well, I presume that what's happening inside the BBC is some people want it to be shown, and other people are saying, no, don't show that, the Americans will get upset. I bet they will.
I mean, you can watch it online. It's on the Guardian website, and I'll put a link on our programme page to it.
The dogs in the street know that the CIA goes around murdering and killing people, don't they?
Now, this is also... There's echoes of this guy, Raymond Davis, who was running around in Afghanistan, equipped with
Pakistan.
Sorry, Pakistan. with all sorts of weapons of mass destruction and dishing them out to whoever seemed to want them.
Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the civil war in the sectarian civil war inside Iraq was being encouraged by the Americans in order to try and divide and rule in good old Roman Empire style. And of course, that's exactly the Sunni terrorists that they were trying to torture inside Iraq using Shia police officers and so on are exactly the same people who they're supporting and arming to try and overthrow Assad in Syria. But of course, countries don't have friends or enemies. Countries just have interests. And the US has massive interests everywhere. And we, especially under Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair, wander around like their poodle or their Rottweiler.
Now, James Steele, he was wandering around in Iraq doing all these dreadful things. I mean, you know, literally seeming to gleefully torture people.
I think one of the special things they liked to do was drilling people's kneecaps with electric drills.
Now, this, I mean, it's quite clear, you know, that there are efforts to stop the British public and other people, you know, sort of in the Western world actually seeing that this stuff has been going on. I mean, he was an American. Is it possible that there are also British soldiers? This guy was a colonel level. I mean, he's a very high level,
Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who used to run the Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland and was going to be prosecuted by Sir John Stevens as a terrorist. Guess where he is now? The last we've heard of him. He's in Iraq, inside the Green Zone, running something called the Joint Services Group for the American liaison with the American Embassy. That's the last we heard of him. But he's actually wanted as a terrorist in Britain.
Well, I mean, if you sit and watch this film, as I do, it almost comes across that we are the evil empire.
That's how we're perceived in lots of the rest of the world, whatever people think on the streets in Britain.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
And I'm joined by Phil Shell now. Hi, Phil. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello. Thanks
now,
for having me.
You're one of the organisers of the Anarchist Book Fair. I can't say you are the organiser, because I'm sure anarchists don't work like that. Just tell us, first of all, what are the basic tenets of anarchism? Because many people will think, well, this is just the idea here. It's just no laws. It's total chaos.
No, it's not that at all. I mean, I really always say capitalism is chaos and we need to organise for anarchy, because it's about people looking after themselves, looking after their own communities and working together without being told what to do, but in a spirit of cooperation. So we're against capitalism because it's a system in which the rich tell the poor what to do. And we're against the state because it's a system in which politicians tell us what to do.
But so it sounds to me like you're saying there should be no system at all. But then that leaves people disabled people without much help, doesn't it?
No, I mean, we've been talking today about trade unions. That's an example of where people come together voluntarily in their common interest to do stuff in their workplace and to work together as equals. So you do that not just at work, but in your community, in your street, to organise public services. And starting on a small scale, like building up layers of government that you enter into willingly rather than being imposed on you.
Well, yes. Well, it sounds like quite a nice idea, building up society from the bottom up rather than the top down. Your book fair, whereabouts is it taking place?
It's at the Trinity Centre this year, the first time we've been at that venue.
Right opposite the police station.
It is, yes.
When exactly is it? When does it open and close next Saturday? Yes. Saturday week, isn't it?
Yeah, the 20th, and it starts at 11 in the morning until 6 in the afternoon. And then there's a benefit party afterwards, because the whole event's free entry and we fund it through donations that people give at the event and at the party afterwards.
Okay, and tell us about some of the groups that are represented there. Who will we be seeing? I mean, obviously there'll be some people selling books, but what else?
Yeah, as well as the booksellers, we organise this whole programme of meetings. This year we're doing it in conjunction with Bristol Radical History Group and Permanent Culture Now. And the topics, there's 30 meetings on everything from unionising your workplace to what's going on in Greece at the moment to what is anarchism and where are we going.
Well, Greece is an interesting one, isn't it? Because I keep looking at what's happening in Greece and it seems like everyone is going out on the streets, as I'm sure you would probably do if the similar situation was here, Phil, and protesting, making a fuss, but nothing really changes in Greece. It all just seems to roll over to another, you know, they're just getting deeper and deeper into debt and they haven't actually changed anything by coming out on the streets in Greece.
Yeah, I mean, I feel Greece is reaching a bit of a critical point. Everyone's been very worried and angry there since 2008. And it sort of needs to be resolved either by the left or what I worry is that the right will resolve it, because people don't want to carry on with this sort of uncertainty forever. So I'm hoping that the left will get it together and can take society in the right direction over there.
Okay, also the Thatcher legacy, got to ask you about that, because she caused lots of protests, a lot of people coming out on the streets against government policies, a lot of bottom-up protests against a bottom-down leader.
Yeah, I mean, she really polarised the country. I was young when she was in power, but I remember her very well. And people still dislike her to this day because of what she did, what she did to their families, and the lasting effects that it's still having. She was great in the sense that she changed this country, but I don't think for the better.
Martin, what are your thoughts about the role of anarchists and anarchism? Because, I mean, in a way, I can see Phil's point that he wants a kind of bottom-up change to happen. You know, people on the streets, ordinary people just deciding we want to change things. But you can't really do that, can you? Unless you've got some sort of top-down movement as well to represent those views at the very top of society.
Well, it's interesting. I'm an activist in Columbia Solidarity, and Andy Higginbottom, he runs Columbia Solidarity. He went to a meeting in Latin America, and there was a struggle between what they call the horizontalistas and the verticalistas. That means the people who want top down and the people who want everything to run on a horizontal level. I am a diagonalista, which is to say, you've got to have a bit of top-down direction and you've got to have some coordination, but ultimately it's got to be grassroots-led. And I think this kind of dialogue about what kind of organisation we need, the anarchists have got a perfectly legitimate role.
Final word to Phil. Where are you on the internet, Phil?
We've got our website, bristolanarchistbookfair.org. You can find us on Facebook as well.
Okay, so I'll sign off now. Coming up, the all-live typical topical Afro-tropical show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem MEP for the southwest of England, Sir Graham Watson. Also thanks to Julian Parry and Mohammed Rafiq, and of course, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, and you just heard there, Phil Showell from the Anarchist Book Fair.